Hello, this is John Himmel, and this is number five in the ongoing series of AdVip podcasts on intimate partner violence. Today, I'll be speaking with Ronald Potter Efron about IPV and substance abuse. Ron is a leading authority, maybe the leading authority on this topic. He's a psychotherapist in private practice in Eau Claire, Wisconsin. He's the author of numerous books, including Anger, Alcoholism and Addiction, Shame, Guilt and Alcoholism, and Family Violence and Chemical Dependency. He's also the director of the Domestic Violence Certification Program for the National Anger Management Association. Ron, welcome to the podcast.
Thank you for inviting me, John. It's an honor.
Yeah, you've been I've been following you for the over the years. For 25 years, I've been conducting batter intervention programs in the San Francisco Bay Area. And for a long time, there wasn't a lot of research for me to draw on. In particular, when I was working with cases that involved domestic violence and substance abuse. And you've been writing about this for several decades. So you've really been a goldmine for me. And as I see it, you've been a pioneer in the area of family treatment for high conflict families and families where there's domestic violence. So it's really a pleasure to have you here.
Thank you.
Sure. So let's go ahead and get started. The first question I have for you, Ron, is how do you determine in cases where there's the client presents with both history of domestic violence perpetration and substance abuse? Should it be treatment of the addiction first or the domestic violence? How do you feel about that?
Well, I think that's a great question to start with, John, because it speaks to the complexity of the situation that we cannot have any overall mandate, like always treat addiction first, which is what the addiction counselors have said traditionally, or always treat domestic violence first, which is what the domestic violence counselors have said traditionally. These are two different schools and their interaction isn't very good. So the answer is it's a case-by-case situation, and you have to ask several questions. One is, does a person's addictive problems preclude any learning of behavioral changes? In other words, if they're so addicted that they can't learn how to take a time out, for instance, then obviously we're going to have to focus on substance abuse first. On the other hand, is the violence or the risk of violence so severe that it just simply cannot wait? In that case, we have to skew toward treating domestic violence, even if it's only partially effective, even if it means the person will have better anger control when they're sober, but not when they're drunk. At least we have to get something, because with domestic violence as against anger management, the bottom line is always saving people's lives, including your client's life.
Yeah.
So there's other issues. Can the person afford and have time to have both treatments simultaneously? That would be the ideal solution, is to have somebody getting treated for domestic violence and substance abuse. It would be wonderful if there were actual clinics that a dual diagnosis clinic that would develop one overall program for the two. But as far as I know, there aren't any like that yet. There may be in the future. You also have to ask, hey, what is the client motivated for? Are they mostly interested in getting anger and domestic violence control? Are they mostly interested in getting alcohol and drug control? You always want to have success quickly, especially with domestic violence and anger management clients. You want immediate success. So you want to find out what they are most motivated to change and what is the most likely to succeed and be rewarded. And then there's one last issue I can think of right now, and that is a very practical one. Who's paying the bill and what do they want? If it's a court order that the person must have substance abuse treatment, I guess you give them substance abuse treatment. You try and squeeze in a little domestic violence material at the same time, and vice versa.
You make some great points. So let me see if I can sum this up. You're saying that among the considerations is the is what seems to be the primary presenting problem is if there's serious violence going on, perhaps if you have to choose between substance abuse treatment and batter intervention treatment, you go with the batter intervention treatment. However, if the person is so wiped out and affected by the substance abuse to the point where they can't retain any information and they can't really function, then it doesn't matter what how good the program is. The batter's program is not going to help them much if they're still using and drinking. But you're also pointing out that it also has to do with the individual's motivation. So someone who may actually benefit more theoretically from, say, a substance abuse program, who identifies as a batterer, might benefit more from a batterer's program just because they're more into it, or they see themselves as needing that more.
Imagine you're a client, and you say to your counselor, "Gee, John, I really want to handle this violence issue," and you say back to me, "Well, okay, Ron, but first we're going to do substance abuse. Once we get that under treatment," you see the point. It's in your the summaries of your research, one of the things you emphasized was motivational therapy and motivational counseling, and the idea of what is the person motivated to change. So it's complicated. There's no one single answer, but hopefully when you're working with one and they see they're getting some success, that will lead them naturally to work on the other.
You said that you weren't aware of any programs that actually fully address
Integrated those.
both problems. You don't know of not even one, huh? That's a that's
I'm not an expert on it. I'm not a big traveler in the field or anything,
yeah,
but
okay.
I can't think of anyone now that maybe a particular counselor. I'll bet you there's many counselors who are well trained in both fields, and they're integrating them as best they can. But
Yeah.
nevertheless, I mean, we ran a domestic violence battery intervention program. We didn't run a substance abuse program. And so if they needed substance abuse counseling, they either had to do it simultaneously through another agency. And you can imagine the confusion. And we're asking people sometimes to go to treatment 4 days a week.
Yeah,
And
yeah.
they look at you and say, how do you expect me to pay for any of this?
Right.
When because my boss says if I don't show up, I'm going to be fired. So it's so complicated an issue. Work with what you can do and start with what you're trained to do, but also what they need the most.
Well, it's so far we've only been talking for a few minutes, but I've already learned some things from you. It's a pleasure to talk to someone who's a clinician as you are, because people who do research don't often understand the subtleties of treatment. And so one of the things that you brought up was that all well to refer people to different programs for all their various problems, but people can only afford so much, and they have to go to work, and they have these other realities to deal with. I find that even though I don't have the time and the setup, I don't have the organizational setup to do a dual diagnosis program, because I am versed in both areas. When I do work with clients who have substance abuse problems, I think I can do a pretty good job of monitoring their progress in my batter intervention programs by, talking to them about their progress in AA, for example, and asking them about how they're doing there and what, they'll bring up, they'll talk about the steps that they're on, or they'll talk about their sponsors. And even though it's not a substance abuse program, during the open discussion of the meetings, the clients are encouraged to talk about the things going on in their lives. So the non-substance abusers are okay with that, as long as we don't, formally take over the group with discussions about AA every week, right? So, but I find that I
Right,
can
yeah.
integrate the two, the domestic violence treatment and substance abuse treatment to some extent, not by having substance abuse as part of the ongoing material, but weave again into the discussions. That seems to work for me.
Sure, we are. And I would be surprised if you didn't have at least one or two lectures on substance abuse and the like within your program. I know we always did, and I tried to present stuff that they wouldn't get in an AA program, and specifically things like what we'll be talking about tonight, how drinking and drug use is likely to make them more violent or more unpredictable in their violence.
Right, right. I had a thought about, what might explain the lack of dual diagnosis programs. And I'll just put this out there and tell me what you think. But as you know, for many years, and even today, the standard sort of acceptable program in the United States, the model is the Duluth model. And the Duluth model explicitly warns us that that substance abuse really has very little to do with battering. And that that battering is about power and control and gender roles. So I'm wondering if just the idea that a lot of people have been trained in the Duluth model, maybe they're sort of reluctant to go there and start talking about substance abuse, lest they be giving the batterer some kind of a way out or excuse for their violence. What do you
exactly
think of that theory?
Well, more so in the past than now. I think
I think
substance abuse counselors and domestic violence counselors are getting a little more aware, and you don't run into too many pure Duluth model people anymore, except in the shelters. But yeah, it used to be that if somebody said, "Well, I have an alcohol or drug problem," the domestic violence counselor would say, "You're just making an excuse. That's not the issue. What we're talking about is learning. It doesn't what you learned when you were a kid about men and women and their relationships to each other." So it was verboten at that time, as was family counseling, working with both partners. You know, so many things were forbidden because of the basically the single cultural focus. I don't see that as important now as it used to be, thank goodness.
Yeah, and you know, I agree with that. I agree. There's a lot more subtlety now. And you're right. I was part of a recent research project where we asked batterer intervention providers across the United States about their model, their theoretical model, and the vast majority said that they incorporated elements of Duluth and CBT and other models. So it seems
anything that works in the field where nothing works very well.
Exactly.
We have to admit that in many ways. I hope that 20 years from now, people will be looking back and laughing at what we've been trying to do, because there will be so much better materials to work with than we have now. But for sure, when the Duluth model had a stranglehold on the program, they did not they could not and did not treat substance abuse very well.
No, I agree. Well, let's go on to the next question, Ron, which you already sort of intimated at earlier. I know that there's several ways that addiction can be interrelated with domestic violence, just not just one way. So what are some of these different possibilities?
Okay, well, I owe this material to an author named White, who I can get the full reference if anybody needs it, but he came up with seven different relationships between anger and aggression and substance abuse. I'll just go through them fairly quickly, and then we can talk a little bit more if you want to on them. One is, and very important to recognize, is that they can be totally independent of each other, which means that you can treat a person's substance abuse until health freezes over, and it's not going to affect their violence at all, or you can treat their violence forever, and it won't affect their substance abuse. Practically speaking, this is the person who said, "Yeah, I beat my wife when I was drunk," and then hesitates for about 10 seconds or so, and then says, "But I beat her when I was sober too." And there's no real relationship between the two. That does happen. It's kind of unusual. The flip side of that, and the second kind, would be a causal relationship. And in a causal relationship, one of the two clearly is the cause of the other. And most likely, It would be that the substance abuse and the typical situation here would be a person who says, I have never laid a hand on my kid except when I was drunk. And the kid and the mom or the dad will collaborate that then. And that as long as they're sober, they do not have a domestic violence problem. They sometimes don't even have an anger problem. These are classic keep the plug in the jug folks. That yes. If they quit, if they don't drink or use drugs, they won't have a domestic violence program. Going back to the original question that you asked, these people belong in substance abuse treatment because the domestic violence is a subsidiary problem. Okay, probably the most common connection is what White called an additive relationship. And that means you might have an anger problem at the level of, let's say, on a 1 to 5 scale, it'd be 2. And you have a drinking problem on a 1 to 5 scale, it'd be 2. But when you drink when you're angry, then they both become 3. that you're more likely to become aggressive verbally or even physically. One adds to the other in a fairly predictable and geometric progression. Even worse than that, though, and I see it occasionally, is what he calls a synergistic relationship. And that is, like, instead of 1 and 2 and 2 gets you to 3, 2 and 2 all of a sudden gets you to 10. That when you drink even a little when you're angry, then you can become just a raging demon and going past anger into true rages. And those are people who clearly have to be told you can't ever drink again, you can't ever get high on amphetamines again or whatever it is, because you're just this is so dangerous. And these are people who could kill themselves and other people easily in a drunken fit. So that's the fourth. Another kind is what the Duluth model people would have used. They said that you're using your drinking and drug use as an excuse for your violence. You want to be violent anyhow, but you can always say it was the alcohol that did it, and basically you're shirking responsibility. Another kind is what White called contextual relationship, and this is the guy who is pretty normal all the time, but goes to the bar on Friday night specifically to, 1, get mad, and 2, get drunk, and 3, get into a fight. And outside of that cultural expectation, which is pretty high in Wisconsin where I live, the person really does not have any great problems. And that would be more closest to the idea of a cultural learning model, that this person has learned that it is accepted and expected that they become violent in that situation. And then the last kind and you do see this one also, is called neutralizing, and that's a person who uses alcohol or drugs or some other form of compulsive or addictive behavior to try to contain or erase their anger. Classically, the person who says, "Whenever I get too angry, I go out and get stoned on marijuana, and that's without that, I don't think I would. I think I'd be killing people if I didn't use dope." I actually had a client like that, by the way, and he came to me, and he said, "Ron, I have a problem." He said, "I've almost killed 3 people already. I've been in jail several times for that. And the only thing that I have found that helps me at all is marijuana." So he had just gone through substance abuse treatment at Hazelden, I think it was. And he said, "I need your permission," he said, "as my counselor, that it's okay for me to use marijuana in order to contain my violence." Well, that puts you in an incredibly difficult situation as a counselor. If you say, "I don't care, you know very well that you're not supposed to use any drugs, and any use of marijuana will probably get you back on the wagon or off the wagon, you'll be using all kinds of other drugs as well. Well, what if that person does kill somebody when they were sober? So you can't say don't use drugs. On the other hand, you can't give them permission, because you could lose your license, quite frankly, if you give them permission to go ahead. And you could certainly lose your relationship with anybody else. So with other referral agencies and even your boss, you might lose your job. So the only thing you can do in a situation like that I discover is to say, look, I cannot give you permission to use marijuana, but my job is to teach you some alternative ways to deal with your anger and aggression so you don't have to use marijuana.
Yeah, I don't think the probation department would be really thrilled if I told them that I was suggesting that my clients start smoking more grass to manage their anger better. There seems to be complicated relationships between substance abuse and domestic violence. Now, as you know, in both areas of treatment, clinicians are always trying to determine what are the risk factors, what are the causes of each. And we know, I mean, you and I know that these causes tend to overlap, but it can get pretty complicated. So tell us about the different ways that each of these problems sort of originate, what kind of causes. Are there sometimes more than just one or two causes?
Gee whiz, you don't ask easy questions, John. that's pretty tough. We could speak to a couple of things here. One is how frequent it these things are, and I think if you included all episodes, like not only a situation where the batterer was intoxicated or under the influence, but also the partner or both of them were, I would imagine you could easily get up to maybe 50% of all domestic violence episodes have some relationship to substance abuse. But I think and you always have to ask, by the way, on that, when a person comes in and says, I had this episode, and they start to describe it, and you have to ask two questions. Who else was violent and who else was intoxicated or using? And if you don't ask them, they often will not tell you. You have to seek out the information, because they don't want to get their family in trouble, and for one thing, and they don't want to admit that the whole family has a problem and not just them. And the other thing I wanted to add to that is you have to distinguish between immediate intoxication and the effects of chronic addiction problems on a person in terms of violence as well. You have to find out before all this happened, what kind of a person were you? Were you violent or not? But another part of this question, I think, that you were asking is at a causal level, you have domestic violence, you have substance abuse, but you also have to look at other things like depression as well as impulsive anger and impulsive binge drinking and depression are all related to serotonin deficiencies. So I call them the big three in the field, and you always want to, when you're doing an intake, you want to check to see if a person also has issues with depression as well as substance abuse and domestic violence. So now we're getting into not just a dual diagnosis situation, but a triple diagnosis situation. Other things like paranoia, PTSD, borderline personality disorder, all of those things can be related almost in a which comes first, the chicken or the egg. A person with borderline personality disorder is very high risk for both substance abuse and domestic violence.
And depression.
And depression. So, right. So we almost have to go back to the beginning, treat what is most available to be treated, and recognize that people are human beings, and sometimes realistically all we can hope for is to lessen the frequency of domestic violence episodes, lessen the intensity of them by helping the person drink less, use less drugs as well.
So I would then infer from what you're saying that whether you're treating substance abuse or you're a batter intervention provider, you want to be on the lookout for mental health issues, in particular individuals who are chronically depressed, because if the depression is driving both the anger, the violence, and the substance abuse, then if you have to get that treated. So the individual might need a referral to a psychiatrist. They possibly need to get on SSRIs or whatever medication are appropriate for that individual, right?
Yeah, absolutely. And nowadays, trauma is such a huge thing, a little bit too huge in terms of so many people are being diagnosed with PTSD and other forms of trauma that has become almost the latest vogue. But I think you have to certainly be aware how people who've been traumatized are so much more likely to be looking to substances to curtail some of their internal pain, and also how they are much more likely to be paranoid and likely to be violent. So everything folds in on itself on the problems, because we're dealing with real human beings. The implication is that the field needs to have the best trained people possible. And we're seeing a gradual professionalization of the field of domestic violence, just like alcohol is and substance abuse before it. And as that happens, we're going to see more and more people with at the level of masters, and rather than just BA or even less, doing the treatment. And I'm not necessarily saying that's entirely good, because the risk is that you'll lose the contact with people who've been there and done that and can really speak to the issues from a personal perspective.
Yeah, I totally agree with that. In fact, I recently put together some trainings that emphasize the common approaches that seem to work across programs, across different theories, because, you know, for example, I sat in on some Duluth type of programs recently, and I was impressed with some of the facilitators and what they were doing. I wasn't impressed, of course, with the curriculum, which I thought was very limited. However, I was very impressed with the way that these particular facilitators were running the group. They were very able to engage the clients. And having been in AA myself, on a personal level, I know what it's like to get motivated by being around people who have been there, who have personal experience. So I get what you're saying, that having professionals take over comes with a downside. They don't necessarily have the same authority that you know, we call newcomers, and whether it's in a substance abuse program or a DV program, that, you know, the newcomers really need to identify with somebody, and they may not be able to identify with a 24-year-old recently graduated, you know, master's degree.
Who came from a lily white family where there's never been any violence at all, if there is such a thing. Our field is moving along fairly quickly. If you'll pardon a little sarcasm on my part, it's like at the level of professionalism, master's, PhD in psychiatry, if there's money to be had, the field will be professionalized. I think that's what's happening. It's not all bad, but it is sort of a cynical thing. And there's also the risk of, okay, well, we'll solve everything by giving somebody a pill, instead of looking at the reality of their lives.
There is one striking difference between peer led or programs in AA and in contrast to peer-led batter intervention programs, because with an AA, for example, there's a concept of powerlessness, that you're powerless over alcohol, which implies that you're just kind of powerless over your life. Whereas the exact opposite philosophy holds in the batter intervention, whereas you're 100% responsible and you can't blame it on anybody else. So could you explain some of the, I think these are apparent, they're not real differences, but they are apparent differences between the two philosophies.
Well, that word powerlessness has been such a difficult concept to understand. In my sense of AA, and I've been there too, it really means acceptance. You know, I'm powerless over my alcohol. My life has become unmanageable. It doesn't mean I'm helpless, and I can use that as an excuse. It means I have to face the reality of my issues. I have given people who are in the AA program a first step, but I scratched out the word alcohol and I put anger and violence in it. I admit I'm powerless over my anger and my violence, and my life has become unmanageable. And that is okay as long as it's followed up with, okay, now that you have accepted this reality, what are you going to do to lessen the risk of your being violent? So as long as the powerlessness amounts to acceptance and it is followed by action, I think it can be really, really helpful, especially for people who are already in the program going to AA. You just have that wonderful program. Let's just add to it the concept of controlling dealing with your anger and aggression. Now, if a person is not in the program or doesn't look at substance abuse from that perspective, then I wouldn't go in that direction at all. Yeah, but right. The issue is, what do you need to do? I always ask a person, when they come to the point of acceptance of their domestic violence, yes, I am a batterer, or even if they won't use the word, yes, I really committed that horrible act. But so many people are so ashamed of what they did. And I ask them, well, basically, now that you're accepting this, what is the first thing you most need to do in order to start changing? And sometimes the answer is, I've got to go to church this Sunday. Sometimes the answer is, I got to go to an AA meeting and deal with my substance abuse. Sometimes it's, I've got to go and make a heartfelt apology to my family. But you're always looking for action steps. What are you going to do with your pain that is helpful? I think that accepting one's powerlessness in that framework can be a very helpful thing, John.
And there's a new offshoot of cognitive behavioral therapy. You probably have heard of it, called acceptance and commitment therapy.
Yes.
ACT. And ACT is nicely, in my view, nicely bridges the two approaches. The idea that in A, that you're powerless over people, places, and things, and yet still responsible for your actions, including your violence. That in acceptance commitment therapy, they point out that the first order of business with intense emotions is not to obsess over them, but to combine an acceptance of them with setting goals for yourself and moving on with your life. And that seems to work really well, not only for the substance abuser that I work with, but also in my batter intervention programs, because a lot of clients say, I've been angry my whole life. I'm a very angry, intense person. And I always tell them, well, no matter how angry you are, no one's ever actually exploded from being angry. No one has actually literally exploded. It's all in your mind. So learn to detach from your emotions. Learn to observe your anger. You take time outs. You can use meditation exercises, relaxation exercises, to find a way to release or let go of your anger, or at least just be okay with it and focus on your behavior. And that seems to run, to bridge the gap for me in a way that I can relate to, you know, on that level to both substance abusers and batterers, teaching them that you know, it's all about setting goals and taking action. But in the meantime, when you're overwhelmed with cravings for alcohol or overwhelmed with desires to strike up your partner, that there's a way that you can separate yourself from those emotions and not identify with them. And ACT, they call that diffusing, right?
Yeah, ACT is very powerful, and it has had some pretty good research results, and that meditative Buddhist kind of component of it, I think has crept into the field. And of course, domestic violence is one of the least likely places for meditation to be effective, because these people mostly are people of action, and they don't think too much in terms of sitting down and meditating. But I have a colleague who regularly does meditation with our domestic violence clients, and she's very good at it. And it's a classic kind of situation where the research says, if you as the therapist really believe in what you're doing, whatever your technique is, and you can sell it to your clients so they believe in it, it's going to be effective. She's so good at meditation herself that her clients, after their initial, let's say, doubt in capital letters, come to accept it.
Right. Let me go back to our discussion regarding drugs and their relationship to domestic violence. Are there some drugs, Ron, that are more related to domestic violence perpetration? You mentioned marijuana. It sometimes actually helps to reduce violent urges. What about other drugs?
Well, let's stop on marijuana, first of all. There's not much research that supports that. There's some research that doesn't support it, some research that supports it a little in terms of it being an effective neutralizer of anger and aggression. If my client really believes in it, then that alone, of course, has a tremendous effect. But I always, when I'm doing lectures on this, I always ask the group, well, what do you think is the most dangerous drug in American society? And pretty soon somebody comes up with the answer, which is alcohol. Because alcohol is legal, and also because it can be so dangerous both as you're getting high, and also when you're withdrawing from it, that the person who is the life of the party at the party and then comes home and beats his wife may be going through withdrawal. So I think that if you wanted to put the drugs in order of danger, that would be the highest of all. And methamphetamine is probably the thing that most people would vote highest now. I was talking with somebody today who is a substance abuse and domestic violence counselor, and I asked him the same question because I anticipated that we'd be talking about it. Mm-hmm. And he said, well, yeah, sure, alcohol. I said, well, what about methamphetamine? He says, not for domestic violence. He said, they beat up everybody outside the house, not inside the house. And I don't know how accurate that is. And I certainly know of people who've been terribly damaged by methamphetamine, but in acts of domestic violence. But I think there is something to be said for that. And also with all the gang violence and stuff, that is more about who's in control of the drugs. So amphetamines, other high-risk drugs, sedatives and barbiturates tend to promote irritability and assaultiveness, and also self-destructive attacks. Cocaine and any stimulant is highly associated with irritability and impulsive attacks. So back in the days when PCP was very common, that was maybe the most dangerous drug of all at the time, because that could affect any human being, and anybody who took it, regardless of their previous personality, could become violent on PCP. Most drugs, you have to have sort of an anger or violence problem, and then it's exacerbated by the drug.
Yeah, so with alcohol, there's a disinhibition factor,
yes,
where an individual who is pretty mellow is just kind of prone to being mellow. The alcohol might make them fall asleep or just be really even more mellow. But an individual who's angry and has a lot of resentments and is high stress, then under the influence of alcohol, that ability to suppress those impulses tends to go away, right?
Yes, and the studies I've seen indicate that it's dosage related, so that the more the person drinks, the more irritable and angry they come until they reach the point where they fall off the bar stool unconscious, in which point they're not much danger to anybody, but it is dose related to a large extent. So, but back to the individualized issues of it, you have to ask the person in front of you, what drugs have you been taking, and what effects are you aware of in terms of the violence? And of course, you can get the other people in that person's life to also give you that information, because they might tell more truthfully what's happening than the other person. You get some odd results. I was working with a gay couple, and there was a severe enough domestic violence, one of the men perpetrating on the other, that I really wondered if I could keep working with them at all, because at a certain point there's some ethical issues about am I just perpetuating the problem by it looks like we're working on it, but we're not having any success. And one day they came in together and they said, well, problem's over. And I said, why? And the fellow said, I'm not drinking wine anymore. And so I asked him what he meant. And he said, I can drink bourbon. I can drink beer. I can drink any other alcohol substance, and it doesn't affect me. But I touch wine, and I become a raging monster. And his partner affirmed it. And I was as skeptical as one could be in a situation like that.
Yeah, I would be too.
But yeah, it's like, what do you mean? Alcohol is alcohol. Well, but there are congeners. Different drinks have different stuff in them. Who knows what it is, or was it a psychological issue? But the bottom line was, keep the plug in the jug. Don't drink wine, and we'll see. And I followed them for another 6 months after that, and the story stayed the same.
Well, Ron, we're coming. We're getting closer to the end of our talk today, but I did want to ask you one more question, and it has to do with a topic I'm very interested in, which is family systems. You're one of the pioneers, along with myself and a few others, who have started to look at how domestic violence and also substance abuse, how they impact the family and impact multiple relationships in complicated ways. It's not just one person who is violent or is a substance abuser whose behavior is impacting a victim, but there's also repercussions with other people that are involved in the family system. So talk about that. You know, how does domestic violence affect the family? How does substance abuse affect the family? And how what kind of reciprocal relationships exist there?
Sure. The classic and the obvious thing is that substance abuse is intertwined intimately and immediately with assaultiveness, with domestic violence. But it's more subtle than that. For some people and some families, situations that normally could be handled well. People are getting a little angry with each other, but it doesn't reach violence. If one person in that family has come home drunk or even a little mildly intoxicated, that can flip the whole family into violence. And we know from some research that once a family takes on that violence role, at least temporarily, everybody in the family changes their behavior. And mom, who had been really nice, becomes, quotes, a bitch. Dad, who's been okay, and now he's drinking and he is insulting, just totally insulting the kids, who are defying them in ways that they normally wouldn't do it. So one person's substance abuse can affect the whole family, change everybody's personality within that family. And The implication, by the way, is that it's not just a matter of one person deciding to change. The whole family has to change, because from a systems perspective, if mom says, I'm going to quit my medication, I'm going to quit taking all this pain medication, and the family turns on her and says, you can't do that, we won't let you, then she's going to go right back to it. So we have to have a whole family commitment to ending violence in the family, not just the batterer, but the whole family has to agree to it. So my first experience in treatment, John, was in an adolescent chemical dependency unit, and we would treat these 16-year-old kids, and it wasn't just for a week or two, it was like at least 28 days, 35 days or so, and then we send them back to their alcoholic dad, pill-popping mom. And we'd say, just don't drink, or don't use drugs. Well, it's the same thing with domestic violence. If we tell our client, be it man or a woman, okay, we're going to teach you all these skills. For instance, fair fighting. Fair fighting is one of the most useless skills you can teach people, unless the rest of the family has agreed to it.
Otherwise, they'll take advantage of that.
Yeah, they'll just treat you like, oh, quit giving us that counselor crap. That was fine in the office. We're sure not going to do it here. So you have to have the family as a whole. And you also have to look for family members using drugs or alcohol or some sort of substance or even compulsive gambling or what have you to get away from violence. That one person is violent in the family and other people escape any way they can, including going into their room and getting high on dope or whatever it might be. Just leave me alone. I don't even want to be in this family. There's a term that, I cannot remember her name. I wish I could give her credit for it. It's called tolerance breaks. And a tolerance break is when somebody who has been with an alcoholic suddenly says, I can't take it anymore, and beats the crap out of their unconscious spouse who's unconscious because he or she has drunk themselves into a stupor. And we've treated people like that in our counseling sessions, and they're almost inevitably terribly remorseful, but you have to help them deal with all the codependency issues that can lead to aggression and violence. But if there's a bottom line, which is every incidence of domestic violence within a family and every instance of substance abuse, especially the two are interrelated, creates a kind of a death spiral. Each one makes it more likely that another one will happen. Each one makes it more likely that another one will happen that is even worse than the one before. So you have to get the whole family involved if you possibly can, and that goes against the grain of all of our treatments, because it's messy, because insurance companies don't pay for that, because ideologically we are committed to so much to individualism in our society that really treating a family, a couple, much less a family, is difficult.
Well, on that note, Ron, I want to go ahead and end our session for today. I want to thank you for doing this podcast. I've learned again from you on a number of points, and I really appreciate you doing this, taking the time to make this information available to the members of the Association of Domestic Violence Intervention Programs, and take care.
Thank you very much. I was pleased to do it, and I hope it will help other people.
You're welcome.